Santa Jones Live today, Thursday the 4th of April. On this edition, UK welfare changes begin. We ask, are they fair? St Andrews is introducing its own currency, but how does that work? We'll be asking the man behind the scheme. After 5.30, you'll hear my interview with Dr. Chris Ogden from the School of IR about North Korea. Will there be a nuclear war? And finally, we ask if the UK should keep Trident. That's all here on Alexander Jones Live. And don't forget, if you don't already do so, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Mr. Jones News. This week, a range of changes to the benefit system began in Britain. Thousands have lost their access to legal aid, and the so-called bedroom tax has been introduced, and they were just some of the changes that have been made. I'm joined now by two people. First of all, I'll introduce you to Thomas Schley, who's president of the Conservative Society here in St Andrews. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
So to begin with, the Guardian front page this week welcomed readers to David Cameron's Britain. It asked, it explained the list of changes and what's going on. Do you like it here in David Cameron's Britain?
Well, I have many reservations about David Cameron's Britain, particularly the impact of coalition government and the long ravages of the Labour Party before it, and also how committed the government really is to what you might call a programme of right-wing reform. However, as far as welfare goes, I think Ian Duncan Smith is probably the minister making the best and the most important and hopefully the longest-lasting progress of any government department.
So you think that actually the changes are positive overall?
I think the changes are very positive. I think they make the whole system a lot easier for people who genuinely require benefits. It simplifies the financial management, it makes it a lot cheaper for the taxpayer, and it helps to save a lot of money that wasn't necessarily deserved or directed appropriately in a system that was very vulnerable to abuse.
So, for example, legal aid has been withdrawn for many cases in the family courts. Is that fair?
Well, there's an awful growing trend these days, I think, towards resorting to family courts prematurely, and I think with limiting the legal aid to such premature resortions is definitely a plus. It will reduce the burden on the court system and make people think twice about breaking up families, which is a significant problem in a lot of deprived areas especially, and connected to people on welfare. And such things as divorces and symbolic litigation and so forth are an expensive luxury which the taxpayer shouldn't necessarily be forced to pay for.
Divorce is a luxury?
Well, I mean, on a practical level, one can live apart from one's spouse for quite a long time and see whether or not things can be got back together. And if you really, you know, involving lawyers, perhaps, I feel, is an expensive way of going about it, especially if that's your point of first resort. So withdrawing the legal aid will make people think twice about it and really consider whether that's best for themselves, their children, etc.
So do you expect the divorce rate to fall as a result of this taking away legal aid?
Well, probably not immediately, but over time, I think it's an important step towards what I think is a big theme of David Cameron's, which is trying to rebuild family values and that unit as a fundamental building block for society.
But many families have less money now than before. Does that help build family values?
Well, it does if it causes them to rethink how they spend their money. And I think the simplification of their financial management with the universal credit system and hopefully the bedroom tax, obviously one of its goals is to free up more appropriate housing for families, which will perhaps breed a better, or a quality of life more directed at their specific needs, and allow, as I said, with the universal credit, the simplified system, they'll perhaps be able to have more family-oriented projects than spending dribs and drabs and getting confused and losing money in the process.
I'm going to bring in at this point Emmanuel as well, and how would you describe your political position, Emmanuel? Would you sympathise with the Labour Party on this?
I think I sympathise with the people who will not be able to afford eating, for one. Let's look at exactly what this policy entails. We're talking on an average, 21,060 people will lose an average of £74 a week. That's food, that's essentially food that goes into their families, housing, paying rent, bills and so on and so forth. It's been calculated by MP Helen Goodman for the Labour Party, so it may be a biased figure, that this actually leaves about £18 a week for food, and she tried living on that and found that she can't do so without having health problems. I think what we have two images of Britain here, and we always knew that the Conservative Party was more focused on the business side of things rather than the social agenda Labour purported to represent, and that's fine, that's what Britain voted for. But what we have here is a situation where, on the one hand, you're aiming to save £2 billion a year by 2014 by cutting essential benefits from people, benefits that are leaving people in a distinct disadvantage. After all, finding a job is a job in itself, and what you're doing now is you're making it less easy for people to go out and find a job, because they're now having to worry about where their next meal is coming from.
But it will cut money from the deficit, won't it?
Well, let's look at that, because we now the claim is this will save £2 billion a year by 2014. In reality, though, we've just with those changes, there was also the millionaire tax break. So, on average, every person who makes more than £1 million will save an average of £42,295.
Reducing it back to the level it was, in fact, still higher than the level it was under Labour.
Yeah. So, essentially, what this means is that the 13,000 millionaire people in the UK who earn more than £1 million will decrease income for the state of £520 million. So essentially, we claim this is to reduce the deficit, but what we actually see is a quarter of that reduction has already been given away to 13,000 people.
But still three quarters which haven't.
Yes, but I'm sure if you look through it, the actual amount you're left with is drastically reduced. And it's all about who bears the cost of an economic crisis that we have suffered. It's all about victimizing the poor, creating a narrative of strivers versus skivers, of people who sit around without actually looking or searching for a job, and people who have a job. Whereas the narrative I think we face is one where there's a big economic crisis that has been caused by a lot of both irresponsible politicians, but also bankers, leaders of industry, and the cost of that crisis is falling on the people who have very little to start with. We're now looking at the poorest getting even poorer and also victimised for being poor rather than being aided in their quest for a better life. And can I just also say something about legal aid? Britain has a reputation as one of the countries with the best legal systems in the world. People come here to settle their disputes from across the world. And what we're saying to our own people is that if you can't afford it, well, so it's tough for you, but justice is, especially in family cases now, is out of your reach. And the idea that divorce is a luxury and you should not really have to involve lawyers is a bit, with all respect to speak, pathetic, because at the end of the day, what you're saying to people who've suffered abuse, who really can't live with a person, is, well, you can't remarry, you can go form a new family, you can legally separate from this individual with the help of the state because, you know, you're too poor to do so. And as a result, you have to live with them and probably negotiate a compromise that is much less equitable than what you would have achieved through the courts. So I think it's a very, very bad month for justice in the UK.
Thomas, today we've seen Unison say that they would like to see a general strike. Is it not just the case now that society is fed up with austerity?
Well, if they are, they're so exceedingly prematurely. We've had 10-plus years of wanton extravagance and much more than 10 years of austerity are thus required to offset that balance. And while welfare reform and cuts obviously are stimulated by a need for austerity, I think they're also beneficial for society in an absolute sense and shouldn't be regarded as the government being as a part of an austerity programme so much as a societal movement. As far as cash savings towards the deficit, Emmanuel mentioned a quarter of it going back towards the highest earners in the top rate income tax cut, but actually, obviously, that policy is aimed not at giving tax relief to the rich purely because they're felt to contribute more by the Conservative Party, but rather because the aim is to help stimulate the economy at the highest level, create more spending and, you know, the classic stimulating economic growth, hopefully creating wealth back down for those on welfare at the bottom and creating more jobs for those unable to find them to find, which is really the goal of much of the work seekers' allowance and claiming policy that's involved in universal credit, hoping to encourage people, really almost force them to seriously consider going back to work if they want to maintain the standard of living they're going for, and that hopefully will be complemented by an increase in the number of jobs from the top-level tax.
Can I flip this on the other side, and I'm going to make it even more disliked by Emmanuel, because actually we're hearing the view from the left here, but there are many on the right of the Conservative Party who aren't happy with what's happening either, and say actually the deficit isn't falling. It's still just rising more slowly and that there need to be more cuts. What do you think about that?
Well, I agree, absolutely. It's a range of government departments are still increasing the sort of quantity of easing policies and things like that I don't think are particularly helpful towards the deficit. And things like the NHS, obviously controversial cutting it, but there are a lot of departments which the government, international aid I think is the most scandalous, which the government has flatly refused to cut in any way, and so that's money going abroad when it could be solving British problems, I think is morally questionable. I agree, certainly, that the deficit is not going down as, or not even reducing its rate of growth nearly as fast as it should be, but I wouldn't say that the welfare reforms don't go far enough, certainly. They're very much on track and just the sort of thing I would like to see from a lot of the rest of the administration.
Emmanuel, what is the alternative to austerity?
Well, that's the thing. Austerity, well, the numbers don't lie. You need to cut back. We need more income coming in, and that's true. We need to cut expenses necessary. But what the question is here is who bears the brunt of the cost of these expenses? It's not okay to deprive people of the bare necessities of house over their heads when the core problem, for example, is that there aren't enough houses to go around, and then claim that it's okay to give £520 million worth of tax cuts to the richest in society. It should be equally shared from the poor and the rich. And in many arguments actually can be said that the rich should bear the brunt of the a crisis that in many ways has been caused by banks. And I think it's simply unfair to sit here and argue that because we have to cut, it means the poor have to pay for the crisis that has been caused by banks.
So you'd have the rich paying more. How much more? What percentage of tax on the rich?
Well, I can't give you exact numbers because I'm not...
What do you think is fair? I'm asking this from a moral as opposed to what's going to meet the deficit numbers. How 60, 70? France, they've tried 70%.
I know but you don't have to go as high. And it's actually an issue of understanding that there's certain things you should be paying for. So you tax the rich more, and I can't say how much more without being ridiculous because I've no clue about exact economics. But what you can do is make sure that stuff like job-providing services like education are funded more, I think. And perhaps you cut certain other aspects. You've mentioned international aid. That's an argument to be had. There are a lot of other areas that can be cut before you resort to cutting the bare necessities your people need to survive.
Thomas, these cuts, ultimately, they're something that the Conservative Party always wanted to do, aren't they? These are ideological. They're not due to the deficit.
No, but I think the deficit has helped the public to see perhaps their necessity, and hopefully the public will see it for long enough for them, the positive social effects to kick in and the benefits to family values and the stimulation of work.
What he means is the crisis has allowed them to get away with this rather than force them to do that.
Thomas, Emmanuel, thank you very much for joining us here on the programme. And we're just going to give you a second while the two of them move and our next guest takes a seat in the studio. And we're moving on to our next story about the town's currency. This is a town with less than 20,000 inhabitants. It's Scotland's oldest university here, and it's the home of golf. St Andrews is certainly unique. But now, even more so, the town is thought to be the first in the UK to introduce its own currency. It's called St Exchange, and it launches on Saturday. And here to explain more is Paul White from Transition St Andrews. Welcome to the programme, Paul. Good, thanks. Thank you for coming. And so, maybe you could begin by explaining to us how this actually will work.
Yeah, sure. So St Exchange is The easiest way to explain it is it's very similar to a local currency, and there's many local currencies already happening around the UK, such as the Brixton Pound and the Bristol Pound, for example. And how they operate is that they provide another means for people to trade locally within a community or town environment. So what Sane Exchange does is it provides basically a currency so that people can offer their skills, their talents, their services, even like homemade goods to the scheme, which other people, members of the scheme, can buy from them and vice versa. So it's really good for people that maybe need something done in their house, you know, maybe need their windows cleaned, maybe need some shelves putting up, or maybe if there's students that want to borrow a car for a weekend, it allows them to do that if they maybe don't have necessarily the time to get it done themselves, or they're a bit short of cash as well.
How many people are you expecting to take part in the scheme?
Well, actually, the event on Saturday is kind of the official launch, but we've already been going for about 4 months now, and we've already got about 50 people who've signed up for the scheme. And we've got hopefully about 40, 50 people coming on Saturday as well. So we're looking to have, you know, at least 100 to 200 people signing up over the next few months.
And how many students do you have in at the moment, and how many are you expecting to be involved with the scheme?
Yeah, actually most of the people who have joined up so far are students, because this scheme has come through Transition University of St Andrews, which is an organisation in the university dedicated to engaging staff and students in climate change and sustainability issues. So far most of the members have been students, however we are getting more and more people from the town involved as well, so that's really good.
What sort of things do students have to offer to the scheme? Because I saw some examples online about plumbers or joiners and how you could start trading those sort of skills. What sort of things would you be expecting students to contribute?
Yeah, sure. Some of the things that the students have put on their sort of membership directory, as it were, is some of them have offered help with certain subjects, tutoring, for example, or proofreading. There's a lot of students who are offering their own homemade breads and homemade jams and chutneys. Yesterday I got a haircut from a friend of mine who's in fourth year. So, you know, things like that, anything that you enjoy doing, anything that you've got a talent of doing, you can pretty much offer on the scheme.
Okay, here's the killer question on it.
Okay.
Is this really sustainability, or is it just tax avoidance?
That's a good question. It's definitely sustainability. One of the reasons local currencies were set up, mainly back in the 1980s, were... when they had a depression back in the 80s, there was a lot of places that had a lot of people that were skilled and had a lot of time, but there was no jobs for them. And there was also no money to do those trades. So especially for, like, you know, plumbers and electricians, there were people out there that needed things done in their house, but these plumbers couldn't actually, you know, do the work for them. So these local currencies allowed them to, you know, do these skills and get honoured for that time that they've spent, and then they can use that money for something else that they might need. And it's kind of evolved from that, but certainly with the recent recession and certainly with the uncertainty in the financial climate, local currencies are really important, because they kind of guarantee a financial resilience for local communities, so that they can keep trading and things can keep happening even when money is getting a bit tight and the economy isn't doing so well. And, you know, no one really knows when we're going to come out of the recession. No one really knows if our current financial system is sustainable. But this system is not about, you know, making profit for, you know, banks or for big companies. All the money is kept here in St Andrews, and it's distributed in a kind of circular economy instead of a linear economy that's kind of encouraging people to profiteer. So it is sustainable, definitely. In terms of tax avoidance, if, say, someone was to start earning a living on or using a local currency such as Sane Exchange, then they would obviously have to, you know, if they were earning money, they would have to declare that to, you know, the tax man.
But the key point is there's not cash exchange. So if a joiner does a bit of joinery and then the plumber returns plumbing, if they both exchanged cash for that, as would happen in normal economic circumstances,
sure,
then that's going through both their company's books.
Yes.
And they're both going to be taxed on that.
Yes, that's correct.
Neither of them is here. So it is the government will lose revenue off this scheme, surely.
Well, local currencies aren't set up to replace aren't set up to replace money. They're set up to be kind of an adjunct to money and to support times when money only goes so far and there's not enough of it to help. I think how a lot of local currencies and our local currencies set up, it's often a very casual basis. And so, you know, that's probably not the best example of, you know, a plumber exchanging time for an electrician. But certainly if, you know, a plumber has a couple of spare hours a week to go around and help someone fix something in their bathroom, then, you know, that's kind of a casual ad hoc basis. And certainly not, you know, their normal daily living. But, yeah, obviously, you know, if it was going to replace money, it would, yeah, you'd have to be very clear about the tax implications. But local currencies aren't about that. They're about supporting local communities and providing that extra kind of step for people that have the time and have skills but just don't really have the money to, you know, get a few extra things, a few extra bits of help with things during the week. So
you mentioned sustainability there and about how this really came about in times of economic hardship and emerged out of the 80s. And so my next question really is on whether it has a long-term sustainable future or whether actually as we emerge out of recession, it's done its bit and people can get back to normal.
I think it that's a good question, actually. I think what Saint Exchange and other local currencies can really do is they can illustrate to other communities, but also local and national governments, of different ways of different economic systems and different ways of trading. And yes, we might come out of the current recession we're facing at the moment, but certainly some of the practices and certainly the way that money is orientated towards you know, big businesses, it's more about these local currencies are more about kind of redistributing that wealth and redistributing it locally. So I think that It's not exactly going to take over and be a replacement for money, but it's certainly going to show governments that this might be a better way of doing things on a national or international level, still keeping the, you know, sterling and such, but certainly bringing into different banking and financial systems, which would make them more sustainable. And also, I mean, it might not be just a financial recession we might face in the future. You know, with challenges such as peak oil, which, you know, oil is, we depend on everything for oil in terms of getting our food to Tesco, for example. You know, the lorries have to drive that from the depots. You know, if oil becomes critical, you know, things like that are going to really challenge us. So having resilient systems like local currencies in place do provide a kind of a fallback system in those kind of circumstances.
You mentioned about other schemes that this was based on. The information I'd read said this was the first in the country. Is that...
No, that's not correct, no. So we've based our system on what's called our local exchange trading system, which is the acronym for it is LETS, and that was set up in the 1980s in Canada. And there's LETS systems all around the world. There's about 60 in the UK, and across the world there's about maybe 300 or 400. And there's also very similar schemes such as time banking, which operate at a very similar level in terms of if you exchange 1 hour of your time for a service, you can get that back for someone else's hour of time for a different service that you might need. So they're certainly not new, and there's certainly many schemes already happening all across the UK.
And is this just this Saints Exchange scheme? Is that for people just within the town boundary, or does it extend to the local community more?
It extends out with St Andrews. So if you're living in the surrounding towns such as Cooper, Pittenween, Anstruther, you're more than welcome to join as well.
And how do people join if they want to?
You can either join on our website, which is www.saintexchange.org.uk, or we have a launch event on Saturday at the Victory Memorial Hall from 11 to 1 in the morning. So come along then and you can find out more about the scheme and find out how to join.
Paul White, thank you very much for joining us
thank
on the programme. Still to come today, we'll be hearing from Dr. Chris Ogden in the Department of IR and his views on the current situation in North Korea. You can hear my interview that I recorded this afternoon just after the latest from Star News. And then we'll be discussing the nuclear weapons situation more generally and what it has to do with the current situation in the UK. Should the UK still be a nuclear state? And remember, you can tweet me. I'm at Mr. Jones News. But for now, it's 5:30 and time for the latest from Star News.
I think maybe in terms of retro... are reportedly moving a long-range missile to the coast.
St. Andrew's charity fashion show donates £27,000 to scholarship fund.
Live from Star Studios, this is Star News.
With the 5:30 Star News, I'm Susanna Sabin.
And I'm Verity Rayside. South Korean sources are reporting that North Korea has been spotted transporting a long-range missile to its east coast. It is unclear whether the missile is carrying a warhead. Sources in Seoul believe that the North is likely to fire the missile around April the 15th, the birthday of the country's founder, Kim Il-sung. The missile is expected to have a range of around 4,000 kilometres, enough to reach Japan or the US naval base on Guam. The news comes as part of a series of similar threats issued by the North in recent weeks, citing the United States as its main target and enemy.
This year, the St. Andrew's Charity Fashion Show raised £27,500, the highest amount it's raised in 21 years. In addition to smaller fundraising efforts, such as publishing an online magazine and selling shaving cream on Raisin Monday, the student-run organization garnered corporate sponsorship and held two fashion shows, one in St. Andrews and one in London during the city's Fashion Week. Organizers and models visited with Principal and Vice Chancellor Louise Richardson yesterday to deliver the check. The money will help fund the Ward Law Scholarship Scheme, which assists St. Andrews students with accommodation costs based on financial need. Over its existence, the fashion show has raised over £300,000 for charities.
Mick Philpot has been sentenced to life for the killing of six of his children at a fire in his home in Derby. Convicted today at Nottingham Crown Court, Philpot was labelled the driving force behind this shockingly dangerous enterprise. The court heard how Philpot set his house alight to frame his former mistress, Lisa Willis, with whom he was fighting a custody battle over their children. Detective Superintendent Kate Maitnall of the Derbyshire Police said, "This has been an incredibly tragic case to investigate, and today's sentences bring this difficult inquiry to a close." Philpot will serve a minimum of 15 years. His wife Mairead and friend Paul Mosley will serve half of their 17-year sentences.
The Charities Campaign is holding its annual summer fair this Sunday in St. Mary's Quad from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Entry is free, and the event will include numerous activities and performances throughout the day. Proceeds from the fair go to this year's six sponsored charities. The event also marks the beginning of voting for next year's three charities. Voting closes next Tuesday and will also be available online.
And finally, the weather. Tonight, mainly dry with clear spells, light winds and some frost inland. Tomorrow, largely dry with long spells of sunshine, some showers.
And those are today's headlines. For more news, tune into our bulletin tomorrow at 5:30 or online, anytime, on the news section of the Star website.
Thank you to the Star News team for that. We're now going to turn our attention to North Korea, and as we were hearing in the bulletin, tensions have been rising there with increasing rhetoric from Kim Jong-un. Today, a US official said North Korea could be planning to launch a mobile ballistic missile in the coming days or weeks. So how likely is it that we're going to see a nuclear war? I asked the question to Dr. Chris Ogden from the School of IR if he thought North Korea is heading towards nuclear war. I spoke to him a little earlier on this afternoon, and here was his response.
I think maybe in terms of rhetoric, belligerence, but I don't think literally. I think that they understand that nuclear war for them would wipe them out completely.
So you think that despite all this rhetoric, what will ultimately happen is nothing?
No, I think what will happen is, say, the international community will posture more towards North Korea. It'll make them realise that they need to find some lasting solution to what to do with North Korea. And I think from the North Korean perspective, it's brinkmanship. They want to gain something back from the international system. Quite often they're overly isolated. They can't really get any foreign reserves. They can't really trade with anybody. And this is a way to try and gain leverage, I think.
And do you think that will be successful? The international community will buy into that, or will they not want to pander to this now North Korea have actually taken this to the next level?
I think if the stakes are so high, i.e. nuclear war is potentially around the corner, I don't think that states will ultimately try and push them over that threshold. I see that as very unlikely. I think more that other states will try and react in terms of building up their own defences, I'm certain now that Chinese politicians, Chinese leaders are trying to pressurise North Korea to pull back. But I don't think it will go over the brink.
Is there any likelihood, any possibility that the current rhetoric could accidentally inflate the situation? That's been one thing that we've heard about quite a lot in the media, is that when no one is expecting it to go to nuclear war, they could, without realising it, end up there.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think that the rhetoric is very... it's increasingly hardcore. It's always quite hard from the from the North Korean point of view. They'll say that they'll turn the South Koreans into a nuclear sea of fire, for example. These kinds of things. But I think there's a possibility that the rhetoric can mount up so much that they get caught by the rhetoric. And once they've made threats so far, that maybe they feel that they have to follow through with them. We should also consider as well why this rhetoric is happening. I think a lot of it is to do with internal politics in North Korea. The leader's very young. He's estimated to be somewhere around 29, 30 years old. There's a very strong military presence, very strong military infrastructure and military pressure. So I think it's a lot to do with him trying to balance against those influences, show that he's, for want of a better word, a hard man, that he's there and that he's responsible. But it's possible that if he bends too much, he'll get stuck. He'll have to fulfil his promises to some degree.
Is his leadership of North Korea secure, do you think? Because there's been a lot of talk, as you were saying, about him trying to prove himself almost to the generals, who are far more experienced than he is. Is he likely to be leader there in 10, 15 years' time?
This is a difficult question. primarily because we don't really know what's happening in North Korea. They are a hermit kingdom. They're hugely isolated from the international scene. On one level, though, you could say there's great continuity. His father was in charge, his grandfather was in charge. There is some kind of dynastic progression happening in North Korean politics. So it's not inconceivable that he'll also rest and remain in power. But really, in terms of the ifs and buts, it's so unknown in terms of even how decisions are made or even the balances of power that it's very hard to answer that question.
What do the people in North Korea actually know about what's going on at the moment? How far do they know all this stuff that's going on in the international media?
I'd suggest extremely little, except from the North Korean perspective.
So they are still hearing this rhetoric from Kim Jong, and they're still hearing at least one side of it. Nuclear war is being brought to their attention.
Absolutely. There's national news, where that can be reached or given to the population. They'll be receiving the official North Korean line. What we consider as belligerence, they will consider as nationalism, protection of the state.
Does the presence of a unification ministry in South Korea help or hinder the situation, do you think?
How do you mean?
Do you think that that actually sends the wrong signal to North Korea and that actually it stops them from engaging constructively with South Korea, with the West, because they see this other agenda?
I think there are multiple agendas going on. There probably are some voices in North Korea who want some form of reunification, just the same as there are voices in South Korea who don't. I think that's just one of the possibilities which could happen. Most states in that region prefer either one, status quo, or two, peaceful reunification. And really, probably peaceful reunification is the best solution in the long term, because it avoids these kinds of situations.
Because there's been some suggestion that some of the things we're seeing happening at the moment, such as US military exercises with South Korea, that it actually causes tensions every year. Mm-hmm. Are we actually just seeing something that is regularly going to be a problem until this issue of the North-South Koreas has been solved?
To some degree. It has been a regular problem. If you consider that he's a very new leader, he must be very inexperienced because of his age. The state is highly militarized. It still has a Cold War mindset. It still believes that it's at war with the South. There's never any formal treaty. That it's understandable that he has to pander to certain groups and that he has to ratchet up the rhetoric every time that they do their war games, South Korea and the United States.
We've touched upon this already, but I want to bring up the role of China as North Korea's only real ally, and a powerful one at that. What are they doing and what should they be doing just now?
They will definitely be conducting lots of diplomatic efforts with the North. They will be asking them not to try and escalate. They will also understand their domestic pressures. In terms of what they can do more, I'm not too sure. One way of looking at North Korea in terms of the international system is that in many ways they're almost unemployed or on the dole in many ways. They can't really find that much income because of their Marxist economy. China, along with many other states, are keeping them going with food aid, other kinds of aid. So I think really that's what they would be trying to do. Pull them away from the rhetoric, try and be understanding. But I think ultimately what's happened, say, in the last 5 years is that China's become increasingly impatient with the North Koreans. They want them to reform economically. They've shown a way of doing that, and they want stability.
And ultimately, China could pull the aid from North Korea and the country would collapse even more than it is at the moment, couldn't they?
They could pull the aid. They have pulled the aid in the past. They do agree with sanctions. Importantly, they're not the only people who give aid or have given aid. South Koreans have, America has, a lot. But really, that could maybe lead them even further down this route. The thing that most states would fear in that region is an act of desperate escalation by the North. That the North feels completely surrounded and that they can't do anything else except lash out. And then the consequences of that are extremely high. South Korea, the US have a strategic alliance. So do the US and Japan. For example, if South Korea is attacked, the US is duty-bound to attack back and take control of South Korean forces. Much the same scenario happens for Japan. So the fear is of that spiral happening and then having no way of turning back.
The US, what role do you think that they should now be playing? Obviously, they're going to be trying to tone down the rhetoric a bit, but we're seeing even just today a US official saying that they think North Korea could be planning to launch mobile ballistic missiles in the coming days or weeks. Is that helping the situation, the position they're taking?
It's a good question. The US itself has a responsibility for its own security. So it's not surprising that they send missile deployments to Alaska or missile deployments to Guam. They want to protect their own resources. Equally, they want to show strength. And often their ballistic missiles are there for protection more than anything else. Ultimately, is it useful? Maybe on balance, yes. Because at least they're providing some reply to the North Koreans. At least there's narratives happening from both sides. The most unuseful thing which is happening is the North Korean rhetoric.
And ultimately, in the worst-case scenario, is that completely between the US and the Koreas? Does that a nuclear attack wouldn't involve Japan or China, would it?
You mean a North Korean nuclear attack?
Or a US response, which presumably would only be on North Korea.
The worst-case scenario is that the North launches two missiles, one to the South and one to Japan, and then they all get involved. And we see.
So, ultimately, presuming that you don't think the worst case scenario is going to happen from what you were saying at the start, in a week, a month, a year's time, what do you think will have happened?
It's impossible to make predictions. But my feeling is that no state ultimately really wants to use nuclear weapons. North Korea has developed nuclear weapons as a means of protecting itself within the international system, as a way of brinkmanship, of a way of gaining resources and surviving in different ways. I think it is inconceivable that the United States would preemptively attack them with nuclear weapons. And I even think that even if North Korea were to even use nuclear weapons, I cannot see why other states would respond to nuclear. I don't I don't see how they would do that. I think it's too irresponsible.
That's quite an interesting view, because I think a lot of the coverage we've seen in the media has been very presumptive that there would be an immediate response on North Korea. What do you think they would
do then? There'd be an immediate response, but a full-out nuclear attack? The consequences are so gigantic. First of all, North Korea and South Korea are extremely... well, they're bordering each other. Seoul is very close to the North Korean border. There's a huge amount of American troops there. If you look to the north, there's China. There are certainly smaller tactical nuclear weapons that that can be used on the battlefield, but they'll still have consequences. There'll still be fallout in the surrounding region.
What other options would the US have apart from a nuclear attack?
They could use other forms of weapons. But I don't fully see that a nuclear tit-for-tat is a very good idea.
So really where we're heading to is just more of the same rhetoric, a standoff and little change?
Potentially.
Dr. Chris Ogden from the School of IR speaking to me earlier today about North Korea. And as we're seeing the nuclear situation growing in tension there, today also in Britain, David Cameron has suggested that we need to keep Trident, our nuclear weapon system, and replace it. He has said that this is not the time to move away and that Britain needs nuclear weapons for its safety. Well, I'm joined again by Emmanuel, who was here earlier in the programme. And Emmanuel, does Britain need nuclear weapons?
Well, it's really a question of values. It's a question of what you think your strategic needs are going to be in the future. On the one hand, you have the idea that we need an independent nuclear capacity to be able to threaten other countries with mutually assured destruction. On the other hand, there's a question of would we actually be a lot safer by investing that money in more conventional nuclear war? Military forces, or even better, in our economy, our education, and so on and so forth. Trident itself is quite an old system. It was originally decided on the basis of the Moscow criterion, which was that we should have the capacity to blow up Moscow if we're attacked. There's several issues with Trident, namely that it would take about four days for it to fire anyway, because of broadcasting depths and the way our submarines work. It's outdated. All the other nuclear powers are increasing their arsenals and improving them, which raises doubts as to whether Trident would be sufficient as a deterrent. And more so, there's issues about whether Trident makes us a target for potential nuclear strikes, just because we belong to the nuclear club. On the other hand of the debate, I would suggest that it does give us a place on the big table. It does mean that when there's talks about nuclear proliferation, we're there with a bigger say for having nuclear weapons. But there's a question to what extent that is something we can rely on in the future, and to what extent we want to rely on that in the future.
So we're seeing with nuclear weapons here, the UK wanting it as much as the status thing. Is the key point here that the government maybe don't want to address simply that no one cares anymore about what the UK think? And if we're looking at North Korea, where we were just hearing about, actually, the countries at threat from North Korea are South Korea, Japan, and the US. The UK's not even on their radar.
Well, the thing is, we want the UK to matter where it counts. So look at, for example, the way we treat piracy. It would be much better if that was our objective, for the UK to count in the international arena, to invest in more warships that can also be used for humanitarian operations, for counter-piracy operations, and so on and so forth. We've never used nuclear weapons. We will very probably never use nuclear weapons, especially not by ourselves. So the need for an independent nuclear deterrent is much less important in terms of our actual prestige, in terms of our actual ability to impact events in the world. And it's more of a symbolic element, something to have to prove that we could bomb you back.
So it's a symbol that's likely to never be used. Ultimately, can the UK afford to replace it, whether it wants to or not?
Well, the answer is yes, we can afford to replace it. The question is, do we really want to pay that much for an outdated deterrent system that we'll probably never use and does not adequately reflect challenges the UK faces today? If you really want to spend that much money on security, you can, and there are very good uses you can put it to. But I put it to you that most of the issues the UK will be facing will be internal, domestic, and the issues we face on the international arena will be better met by having a greater maritime capacity, for example, than having more nukes.
Is the UK now actually just trying to keep up with the rest of the world? The rest of the world wants nukes, and so they do too. Is there any prospect, do you think, that we'll actually move away from countries feeling they need nuclear weapons to have status in the world? Will we see some form of disarmament?
I think that depends on the future of North Korea, to an extent. If an agreement can be found there, and if the UK could take the moral high ground and say we're leaving nukes behind because they no longer reflect the world we live in and the challenges we face, I think that is something that could happen. It's a choice that has to be made and an expectation that needs to be lived up to. But it's very much up in the air for us to do.
I'm particularly interested by some comments that Chris Ogden made in the interview with me about actually he thinks that even if North Korea send a nuclear weapon into South Korea, Japan, into another country, that actually the US wouldn't respond with a nuclear attack. They would see that they actually have to take the moral high ground and probably respond with conventional troops. Does that mean that nuclear weapons are worthless if they're not actually willing to use them?
Well, if that is the case, they will be worthless. On the other hand, I doubt, actually, how much that would be the case. I think there's a big imperative to use nuclear weapons if your ally gets attacked, which is why I think there's little point in the UK maintaining its own independent capacity when any enemy that would attack us would also be an enemy of the States.
Emmanuel, thank you very much for that today and European Saturday in the programme. Thank you. I'm joined now by the SRC External Campaigns Officer, Callum Bryce. Earlier this week, the principal of the university, Louise Richardson, claimed that £9,000 was good value for students in St Andrews for St Andrews education. And she claimed that although the university isn't in a marketplace for education, that it is worthwhile paying that. Callum, is she right? Is £9,000 good value for St Andrews education?
I mean, before the programme, you said to me, let's not talk about tuition fees, let's just talk about what she said. I don't think you can separate the two. I think it's almost an ideological thing that she's, when you're talking about St Andrews, and we're actually used to talking about it now in terms of, is it good value, in the same way that we talk about buying a house or a car, that is, it's setting up people to understand that, oh, I'm buying an education, I'm not going to university, the best university for me, the university where I can get the best education. She's using the words, it's worth a great deal more. That, as much as she says, I'm opposed to marketization of education and we're not a market, she's just setting people up to think in terms of that education is a commodity and it is a market.
Yeah, I think that's interesting comments, and I'm particularly wanting to really get to the bottom of why she actually made these comments. Now, that's the thing that slightly intrigues me, is we know the reaction the press are going to take when she says this. We know that the likes of yourself are going to come out to students and say, £9,000 for fees, that's ridiculous. But actually, she's still making the comments. Why is she wanting to do that?
It does seem very strange, considering I think most of the reaction articles will probably feature in their first few lines the words Will and Kate, and will probably have kind of a veiled, just they'll insult St Andrews as much as they can throughout. They will say everything but posh bastards in their articles. So she must have known that was going to happen. And I don't know why she didn't say why she said this. And the university have since released statements basically saying, you know, we need to spend that much. And perhaps she's just trying to be honest and say, you know what, maybe she really does think this. Maybe the university really can't afford to charge less. And she believes that this is just. But I think, unfortunately, as I said before, that when you talk about it in these terms, you are just setting people up to believe, to think in terms of a commodity.
St Andrews does get a very negative press from particularly the Glasgow Scottish dailies. And again, she had this when she made comments on independence not so long ago. Is this really building the bridges that you and the SRC would be hoping to see? Or is she actually trying to tear down some of your hard work?
I mean, I've only been in the SRC for approximately, I guess, 4 days now. So I'm not quite sure how much of it's my hard work. I mean...
Your future hard work.
My future hard work. I will definitely be working very hard, thanks to all that voted for me. I'm not quite sure about that. I have mixed opinions about her time as principal of this university since I've been here, just in general. I mean, I'm not sure if you're aware, there's a conference coming up. I think it's the largest conference of its kind on the conflict in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Massive support from the schools of IR, medicine, divinity. But Louise Richardson has actually contributed very, very little to this. And it's that sort of thing. It's student-led initiatives that she's not really paying too much attention to, I feel. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if she's intentionally burning bridges with the Scottish government. I think she's Alex Salmond's education advisor, so... I don't think, and I don't actually think it's just the left-wing papers in Glasgow. The Daily Mail hate us as well.
And this is ultimately about the image that St Andrews has with outsiders. And I know that an academic was saying that actually St Andrews and Edinburgh as well, to an extent, but certainly St Andrews, that there are things that other universities can do and get away with. But when it's one of the St Andrews, Edinburgh, the posh universities, they can't get away with it.
Well, no, I mean, no university should get away, in my opinion, with charging £9,000. I think that's, quite frankly, ridiculous, disgraceful and embarrassing. But, yeah, particularly St Andrews in the context where it took 14 students from the least affluent 20% of communities in Scotland. So the students accounted for less than 3% of the student body in 2010, 2011. So, you know, we should be held to a higher standard. It's not just... I mean, we are... essentially posher. We are essentially, we do recruit primarily from social elites, from middle classes. So we should be held to a higher standard when Louise Richardson, who is a respected figure, says something like this.
As well, she says that £9,000 is good value. Yeah. I'm aware that many students here are paying a lot more than £9,000, many international friends.
And other people aren't paying anything at all, which yes. I would prefer.
So the international students, are they being ripped off then under her analysis?
I think when you consider, say, an IR student in St Andrews is paying, an international IR student, as most of them are, is probably paying, what, 20 grand a year, probably more when you factor in accommodation and food, for 2 hours of class a week and 2 hours of lectures. That's not good value, even if you really only want to talk in terms of the market and as education as something to be bought and sold, 4 hours of contact time is not good value. And, I mean... when you're thinking those terms, we're just spending money on a piece of paper at the end of our time at university. And to essentially say, well, this piece of paper is worth 36 grand to people from England and Wales and Northern Ireland, and it's worth, say, 100 grand to internationals, that's essentially what she's saying.
Is education a market?
I think for the past 10, 15 years or so, there have been more moves to the American system where it is more of a marketplace. I mean, 9 grand is still cheaper than, say, most private schools, and St Andrews feels quite a bit like a private school. But, I mean, I think it's quite conceivable that education in 10, 15 years now, from now, either it could revert back to a system where it's paid for, where it's free for everyone, not just Scots and European people. Or it could be very much an American system where it is fully a market.
Finally, whether you're paying fees or not, you're still choosing your university. There's still an element of choice. So that surely means that there is some degree of market there.
I mean, there is. But, you know, should someone have to decide, say, St Andrews is, I think it's the best place to study IR because I'm here doing IR. I mean, should someone have to take into account, well, I'll have to spend another year to go to the best place? I don't think that's right.
Callum Bryce, thank you very much for joining us here on the programme. And that brings us to the end of today's edition. Remember, throughout the week, you can tweet me. I'm at Mr. Jones News. Thank you for your reactions today and do stay tuned. We'll be back again next week at the same time. And you can catch this whole programme as a podcast on the Star website very shortly. Thank you to all my guests today and to producer Carla. And I'll be back at the same time next week. But for now, good night.
Tune in to Star, University of St Andrews radio station.
St Andrews' only radio station.
This is Star.
here at the studio by buzzing the studio from www.standrewsradio.com.